والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week, we'll look at a new story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we'll break it down from a Muslim perspective. Today, we're going to commemorate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which culminated in the coming to power of the Islamic Republic in February 1979. And we're going to focus on the Islamic values that this revolution espoused, such as the necessity of governing Muslim societies by the laws of Allah and the need for Muslims worldwide to unite. But first, here's a report looking back at those momentous days in 1979.
On February 1st, 1979, millions of Iranians welcomed the return of their charismatic leader Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, the imam who led a revolution which toppled an oppressive Western-backed regime and changed the course of history. Imam Khomeini's arrival to Tehran following 15 years in exile intensified months of popular protests against the Pahlavi regime. 10 days later, the rallies culminated in the downfall of the regime, ending the more than two millennia of monarchy in Iran. Imam Khomeini not only stood for Iranian self-determination, but pushed for Muslim unity, strength, and Islamic anti-imperialism, which the Muslim world had yet to see rise to a level which could effectively oust Western hegemony over Middle Eastern countries. The Islamic Revolution also established a new political system, a republic based on Islamic values and democracy. Since the revolution, the lives of Iranians have improved tremendously. Life expectancy has increased from 55 to 76%. Literacy rating risen from 47% to 96.6%, with a medical, sporting, and scientific ranking to rival the world's best, and a powerful military which assists the region's struggle against terrorism and colonialism. Imam Khomeini's revolution proved that Muslims can win against the odds, and Islam can work in a modern political setting.
Well, joining us in the studio today to talk about Iran's revolution and its Islamic significance, I have Masoud Shajare, who is the chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission here in London, and also Sister Batul Subaiti, who is a political activist and commentator. Welcome to the show. Thank you both very much for coming on. Now, Masoud, I want to come straight to you because I was surprised to learn you appeared like a young man to me, but you apparently were around during that time, and you may have some memories of the revolution, which I don't have, for example. Could you just tell us, what was it like to go through that period, the real revolutionary decade after the revolution took place?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. First of all, I think it's very important to realize what was the environment just before the revolution in Iran, and indeed globally. Islam wasn't recognized as relevant to that time's people's political, social, economical sort of needs. It was seen as a fuddy-duddy sort of Eastern religion, which was something of the past and no relevant to the present. And that's on one side. And the other side, Iran was going through huge sort of difficulties, you know, the dictatorship of Shah, and the fact that economically, politically, Iran was really bottom, and you know, the Shah was number one sort of agent and servant of the West, but it wasn't actually able to do anything for the ordinary Iranian people. there was such unhappiness within Iran. And I remember going to Iran just a couple of years before. And when I came back, I was talking to everyone and saying, look, it's not going to go on like this. There's going to be a change. I didn't expect it to be so soon, but it was obvious that the situation in Iran cannot continue like that. You know, the poverty, the injustice, everything was so ripe. But what happened with the revolution was Ayatollah Khomeini brought the spirit of Islam as a revival, as a tsunami, not just for Iran, but the whole world. You know, even in South America, who weren't really followers of Islam by any definition, they were inspired by the revolution of Iran because it stood against the number one stooge of the United States, which was abusing his own people for the benefit of the that colonial power. And I think that was something which didn't... It was a tsunami. It affected the Palestinian movement. It affected the Islamic movement around the world. Mm. Islam was seen as a revival tool, an empowering tool, which could actually undermine the tyranny of the time.
Yes, we are going to speak more about the sort of ripple effect that the revolution had on the region, how it's helped other countries, other peoples as well. But Batul, I want to bring you in on this as well, because you perhaps represent a younger generation, of course, who perhaps look to the revolution still. Just tell me, what does the revolution mean to you, and what does it represent for you today?
Ultimately, to me, it represents dignity. It's a manifestation of the ayah from the Holy Quran, so how many times have an entity that's small in number and, let's say, a material strength has overcome an entity that's much larger in number and material strength by the way of God? So, of course, Islam is the determining factor, and it's the true identity for the people and for the society of Iran, which I think is something that really makes it stand out, is that Islam is not being used as a cover for the interests of those in power. In actual fact, Iran has had to basically let go of many short-term, you know, benefits or interests in pursuit of those higher objectives and in pursuit of those principles. And I see that Iran today in the region is probably the only country that's really standing as an obstacle to the Western imperialist project and has demonstrated that full hand. Not only is Iran stable today, but it's looking to create a new world order, one that that constitutes of respect, cooperation, growth, expertise. And look, it's been over four decades since the advent of the revolution. Its ideals are still very much within the hearts and minds of the Iranians, and I would say beyond. And I would say that for the younger generation, there's actually overpowering feelings. And we have to understand that this younger generation hasn't actually witnessed the revolution firsthand. It hasn't even witnessed the eight-year war. But look at the way that they, for example, commemorate their martyrs. You know, look at the way that today they commemorate the likes of Haj Qasem Soleimani. And this is all despite the soft war efforts to basically weaken and to target their faith. So we have to put it within that context. So I think that shows that the revolution has a dynamic understanding of the needs of the younger generation that are inherently attracted to it.
And of course, I think it's worth mentioning that Iran right now is facing a kind of Western pressure campaign. Mm-hmm. And in specific, they're focusing on things like the woman's rights in Iran. Yeah. Tell me, do you think that the Islamic Revolution has compromised on women's rights in Iran, or perhaps has empowered it, surprisingly, in another way?
I think the Islamic Revolution has actually taken away those factors that would otherwise abuse a woman, essentially. I mean, if you look at the West, for example, you see that a woman is viewed as both a consumer and a merchandise. She's viewed as a product that buys and sells, and her worth is only seen insofar as she generates capital and revenue. Whereas you see that actually one of the core moral values and structures is to focus on the family institution, strengthening the family institution. The role of a mother, for example, that she plays in terms of nurturing the future generations, that's something that's very much focused upon, and the value of a woman inherently and instinctively, as well as her participation in wider society. We see that, for example, the hijab is seen as an essential component to strengthen the family institution and to also facilitate the role of a woman in wider society. Imam Khomeini, you know, very famously, when he was speaking to a group of men, he told them, you know, do you think it is your speeches that have brought down the Shah? It is these very women. Treat them with honour. What he was saying was that these women were leading at the forefront of the protest movements. They were disseminating the education. They were disseminating the information within wider society, the only caveat that I would say was placed was that the hijab is the means and is the vehicle through which a woman can interact in society to maximize that productivity and that effort. So I would say actually the obstacles that would take away a woman's productivity and potential have been removed, and actually she's been respected and honored for the output that she gives to society, as well as her innate role that she plays as a mother and as a wife.
Well, that's really insightful. Thank you so much for sharing. And Masood, I want to ask you about the work that you've done here in the UK. It's been very much focused on, you know, bringing Sunnis and Shias and different Muslims from different backgrounds together to kind of achieve a joint objective towards empowering Muslims and so on. But that's also something which the Islamic Revolution has tried to achieve on a bigger regional level. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think the fact of the matter is that the Islamic Revolution was a reflection of what the command of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is. So when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Attasimu bihamdillahi jami'an," and orders you to come together, any Islamic movement has to put that as one of its sort of aims and objectives. You know, Islamic movements, so-called, who think they could go by creating fractions and grouping and, you know, theological sort of basis and ignore everyone else, it's going against that verses of Quran, and indeed against the concept of Islam. To unite, I mean, look, every Muslim and non-Muslim knows that for us to achieve our aspirations as Muslims, we need to unite, and we need to come together for those issues. And indeed, we need to even unite with others other than Muslim for those issues. To be involved in sort of sectarianism and so forth, it actually is counterproductive to that. So it was absolutely essential for the Islamic movement and the Islamic Revolution to have that as one of his aims and objectives, and I think that's essential for any Islamic movement.
Yes, of course, sectarianism is a poison which has plagued the region for far too long, and it's great to see Absolutely. That there is a nation, the Islamic Republic, in the Middle East, which is fighting against that. However, before we continue this discussion, I want to bring in and remind ourselves of a particular Quranic verse which is often associated with the Islamic Revolution. The verse in the fifth surah of the Quran tells us that Allah will always replace those who turn away from Him with people who are better and who will strive in the path of God, no matter how the disbelievers dislike it. Batul, I want to come back to you on this, because one thing which Iran has done very, very well since 1979 until now, which doesn't get nearly enough coverage, particularly in Western mainstream circles, is the effort that they've done to combat extremism, combat terrorism. In fact, Iran has played a huge role in defeating notorious terrorist groups like Daesh, for example, in Iraq. Perhaps you could elaborate on that a little bit more for us.
Absolutely. I think at the crux of it, Iran has an open hand policy. So that is every oppressed individuals, no matter what their background is, no matter what their religion is, no matter what system of governance they have in place, they will unite on the basis of causes and on the basis of those inherent values. So we see that, for example, when Iran had to fight, because Iraq had invaded essentially during the Iran-Iraq war, that did not stop it. The fact that the whole world was, you know, besieging and sanctioning Iran and all kinds of weapons and ammunitions were used against them, still then, when they were at their lowest point in terms of material strength, did they still reach their hands out to the Palestinians to support them, essentially, in their fight against the occupation? It did the same thing in Lebanon. You know, Iran was crucial in the formation of Hezbollah and in their support, Lebanese liberation group, which essentially defeated Israel in 2000 and drove them out. And Haj Qasem Soleimani is one of the individuals who is hailed as having a key role to play, essentially, in the imparting of the strategic, basically, advice and training that he had had. So ultimately, what it is that Iran has a vision. And that vision is that wherever there is oppression, that oppression needs to be uprooted. And that oppression is uprooted by giving the necessary support to those individuals on the ground and training them such that they can become self-sufficient to fight that enemy. You know, the overcoming of the enemy won't happen unless the individuals themselves on the ground want that to happen. So, for example, we see that even within the Palestinian liberation groups, they would train them how to create bullets, for example. They would train them how to create these tunnels. Rather than making them kind of dependent, they would seek to make them self-sufficient. And it sees the struggle as one united struggle against a greater enemy. So it's like Imam Khomeini defined America as the great Satan. So anyone that wants to support in weakening the hegemony of America, we will support in that pursuit. We will unite for that objective, essentially.
And it's interesting, isn't it, how nowadays you find that Iran has a relationship with many countries around the world who are not Muslim majority. Venezuela, for example, Iran has played a role in helping them. So, Masood, I'm going to come back to you because it seems to me as if you look at how Iran is now to how it was back before 1979, the misconception is that Islam removes human rights, that Islam is anti-education for women, that type of thing. But actually, surprisingly, women education is at an all-time high in Iran. Literacy level has improved since the revolution, that type of thing. And now Iran is a world competitor in the field of sciences, sport, and so on. So perhaps you could elaborate on that point as well for us.
Yeah, of course. I mean, what the sister said regarding the saying of Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, that women were instrumental in bringing the revolution. They were also the actual beneficiaries. They benefited a lot more than the men in as a result of the revolution. The number of sort of women at universities, the number of judges, the number of the lecturers and professors, and politicians. It really is not possible to compare it with Shah's time. You know, at the Shah's time, the freedom for the women was dependent on the inches of skirts. You know, the higher it went, you know, there were more freedom. Well, here you could actually measure it by empowerment of women to take their rightful place. But also, I think Iran, although was the number one importer and buying weapons from United States, when the war took place, Iran was not capable, didn't have the resources, except the manpower and the dedication of the Mujahideen to actually defend itself. Now Iran is a regional power. And when you look at all the other technology, you see that Iran is number 5, number 4, number 7 in the world, despite all the sanctions and everything. I think what is really important is that we need to ask the question, why is it Iran being singled out with this sort of attack by global sort of West, day in, day out? Is it really anything to do with the human right, for example? You know, when we see the Saudis have actually given death penalty for someone for tweeting, and the world is completely silent, and then in Iran, someone gets death penalty for killing people in the demonstration in front of the international community and on the cameras, then there is a huge opposition. So we need to actually be able to have a filter to understand that, you know, what is going on. There are at the moment 127 channels beaming sort of Farsi into Iran. I mean, this is not economical. This has all been fabricated. This has all been organized. This is really a tool of trying to undermine a country which is not just standing for is independent, but also is the aid for all others, including Venezuela, including South America and elsewhere.
You've mentioned, of course, a kind of criticism campaign against the Islamic Republic that does exist. Criticism ranges from things like they claim it's a dictatorship, They claim that, you know, Iran is being expansionist and is trying to pursue some kind of Persian Empire building project in the Arab world, that type of thing. How would you respond to this type of criticism? What would you say about it?
You know, I mean, look at the... I mean, forget the spins. Look at the reality. Look at the statistic. Look at the history. Iran hasn't invaded any country, you know, for hundreds of years. You know, Iran has actually, as the sister said, helped and support others to be able to empower themselves against one of the greatest atrocities against them, like the Palestinians, like the Lebanese, like Venezuela. You know, it really is not even there to sort of colonize everywhere else, is there to help and support, despite the fact that itself is under huge pressure, a pressure
sanctions. But Saul, I want to bring you in because we haven't got a lot of time left before the end of the show. Again, I want to give you a chance to respond to some of the criticism. Other criticisms include, for example, that it's a revolution for Shia Muslims. You know, this is a Shia Muslim majority country. It's ultimately for them only. That's their main interest. How would you respond to that?
I just want to respond to a thing before that, and that is on the point of dictatorship. And it is that Iran is a very active and energetic nation. So in 1979, the whole world was seeking to crush this revolution. That was the whole point of the eight-year war. That's the whole point of the economic sanctions that we're seeing today, that Iran has turned from a challenge to an opportunity. So essentially, for someone to come and to say that it's a dictatorship, okay, Iran right now is being sanctioned for this revolution. Who is maintaining this revolution? What is its support base? Its support base is the people, because where else is it going to get that support? It doesn't have any kind of foreign support. And if you look at the inherent institutions within Iran, they're in such a way that they rest on the people. They're made up of the masses of the people. And they're designed to monitor each other. For example, just take the IRGC, the Besiege, for instance, these different institutions. So if today, if really and truly the Iranian nation today did not want an Islamic Republic, and the world is telling Iran that if you get rid of this Islamic Republic, we will remove these sanctions away from you, it doesn't make sense to say that the people in Iran actually are not happy and want to remove the system. Yes, they have their criticisms. Of course, they have their criticisms like in any other country. But what actually the people in Iran are asking for is for the government to get closer to the Islamic ideals. It's to get closer to the models. They have a problem with the reformist ideologies that is, you know, bringing about more of a neoliberal model. That's the kind of internal critique. A lot of internal criticism happens not to remove the Islamic component. It's like, oh, this revolution is meant to be based on full social justice. So we want to see more of that being enacted within internal policies. And of course, Iranians are very, very smart and politically aware and read. So they're aware of what the external reality is like. They're aware of the machinations of the enemy, essentially. And in terms of this question about it being, you know, Shias, I think, like Brother Masoud was saying, the reality speaks for itself. If Iran is going out, if Imam Khomeini went out of his way to cut ties with South Africa because of the apartheid, if Iran goes out of its way to be the only entity to ship oil and fuel to Venezuela that's under the same sanctions for the same pretext that Iran is in, and that is because it's trying to carve out its own trajectory in its own line, if Iran goes out of its way to support the Palestinian Liberation Group like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and Haj Qasem Soleimani even himself stressed that we don't give weapons and support on the basis of whether you are Sunni, whether you are Shia, what your background is. You either surrender to the enemy or you face the enemy. That is ultimately what determines whether we will be supporting you or it's futile, essentially.
Unfortunately, Batul, we are out of time, but I think you've summarised your point very, very effectively. And to you, Sir Masoud, thank you to you both for joining me, and thank you for everyone at home for tuning in as well. But don't worry, next week we'll be back for another edition of Eye on Islam. But for now, it's Assalamu Alaikum.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio. with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on The Key, we would like to offer our condolences to our esteemed listeners because today is marks the demise and the death of the daughter of Imam Ali and the sister, the noble sister of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the Lady Zainab salamullah alayha. Today on The Key, we would like to ask a very significant question, and that is about the virtues of this noble lady. What did the Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet, have to say about the virtues of this noble lady? We have many hadiths regarding the virtues of this noble lady. For example, the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, has been reported to have said, I advise the present people, the people present, as well as those who are absent, people who are alive right now from my ummah, as well as those people who will come later. I advise them to honor this daughter, this woman, this noble lady. And it's very interesting, and this hadith is very beautiful, because in this hadith, the Prophet also says that, mentions the reason why this is so. He says that, surely she is similar to the great lady Khadija. We all know that Hazrat Khadija, right? She has a very high status in the eyes of the Prophet and Allah and in Islam in general. And she's been mentioned as one of the four greatest ladies and the most noble ladies of paradise, right? And the Prophet mentions the fact that the Lady Zainab is similar to her in many respects. And that's why we should honor her and respect her. When the Lady Zainab was born, it's also been mentioned that the Holy Prophet cried. Well, when he was asked why this is so, he said that, I cry because of this beloved daughter, this beloved girl. She will be afflicted with a very painful and sad fate. And a very sad fate. And this has been embodied before me. I see before me all of the problems and all of the painful events that she will go through. Right? So these are some of the hadiths which have been mentioned. It's also been narrated that according to Imam Ali alayhi salam, also said that his daughter, the Lady Zainab, she had a very high status as far as knowledge is concerned. It's been reported in some hadiths that regarding the Lady Zainab, from one of the A'imma alayhi salam, that she was a lady with knowledge who had not been taught by human beings, which is kind of a reference to the fact that the knowledge that she had was given directly to her by God, which is something very amazing and kind of alludes to her great status and her great stature amongst the A'imma alayhi salam. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the virtues of the Lady Zainab in the words of the Holy Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
IRIB English Radio. Thank you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
Many farm workers are still out of work and struggling to afford food in the wake of California's disastrous floods. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Truthout wrote in this regard, one-third of Javier Zamora's organic farm in Santa Cruz County in California is still inundated with water and debris that, under the pressure of ongoing storms, burst from the soil and Carneros Creek. The whole 22 acres just became a lake, he told Truthout. Zamora, the owner of JSM Organics, lost his full strawberry crop, which alone cost $144,000 to put in the ground. Like many growers, he has only just begun assessing the full extent of damage to his farm, which he and his wife pieced together acre by acre over 11 years. He imagines it will amount to no less than $250,000 in damage overall. But Zamora has insurance and trust the disaster relief process. The worst part of the flooding, he said, is that he can't afford to pay the usual 16 to 18 employees who work through the winter. Zamora, whose firm also serves as a classroom for workers he hires and mentors, usually scales down from 48 workers to just over a dozen in the winter months. But this season has been different. He says, I'm broke. There is nothing to sell. The soil is saturated, Zamora said, noting that other extreme weather events like wildfires have also caused dips in employment for farm workers, though for much shorter 2 to 3 day stretches. This is the first time in his experience that operations have been stalled for weeks on end. Though Laura Burst worries that workers who are called on to return to work will be asked to tackle hazardous tasks. These conditions where it's really muddy, slippery, it's cold, your fingers get numb, your feet get stuck, you're operating sharp tools in some cases. This is creating dangers for workers in what was an already risky job. According to the United States Department of Agriculture's National Institute of Food and Agriculture, agricultural work is statistically the most dangerous form of labor. Amid back-to-back deluges, California Governor Gavin Newsom missed a major opportunity to provide relief earlier this month by failing to include funding for unemployment benefits for excluded immigrant workers in this year's state budget proposal, unveiled on January 10th, in spite of ongoing urging by activists. It was an intervention that, while far from a comprehensive solution, could have had an immense impact, advocates say. The decision followed his December veto of proposed legislation to support farm working families in the midst of increasingly variable climatic conditions, which would have made available $1,000 per month in supplemental assistance to households with at least one farm worker. In response, on January 20, a network of 120 advocacy groups known as the Safety Net 4 All Coalition launched a campaign to extend unemployment benefits to undocumented workers on the heels of similar legislation passing in Colorado. A complementary effort is also underway in New York. Oriola Maceda Mendez is a member of the coalition and director of programs for by a National Center for the Development of Oaxacan Indigenous Communities, which serves an estimated 160,000 primarily indigenous migrants from Mexico, many of whom now work agricultural jobs and live in California's Valle San Joaquin. Mendez says not having access to unemployment like other workers with documents is not only unfair but also groundless. They pay us the same, they take the same deductions from our checks, and we all pay taxes, she told Truth Out, adding, where is this money? Where are these resources? Plus, according to the Safety Net for All Coalition, California employers pay $489 million in unemployment insurance taxes on behalf of undocumented workers, which in theory should mean there are funds to be had. We are in a moment in which we need to demonstrate solidarity, Mendez says. We need to appreciate farm workers for the work that they do day to day, not just with words, but appreciating them and recognizing them by way of providing benefits. At the intersection of social and environmental crises, it's worth noting what is within our immediate sphere of influence, which activists urge include measures like extending the social safety net to all workers, regardless of immigration status, and ensuring that farm workers earn a living wage. Those changes in turn have the potential to lessen the negative impact of the climate crisis, including the sharpening force of winter weather in California on vulnerable, skilled, and essential workers. We cannot control a storm, but we can control the fact that the workers in our food system are paid poverty wages, Delora Burst said, adding, American agriculture is built on the assumption that there is going to be a low-wage labor force that is almost outside of the protection of American law, whether that's undocumented workers or sharecroppers, the Laura Burr said, adding, that's really what we are trying to change.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another episode of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we answer your questions, issues that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Well, today in our studio, we have had this pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, in today's episode, we are going to ask you certain questions that are going to help our parents to carry out upbringing in a better and Islamic way. Well, when it comes to clothing, everyone wants to be relaxed at home. He wants to be in the very easy clothing, whatever, when it comes to women, when it comes to men, when it comes to children, everyone loves to be at ease. However, in this easiness, sometimes we forget what is called as modesty. What do you suggest to the women, especially the mothers, who are actually facing their teens all the time at dinner, at morning, breakfast, lunch, and all the time in the family, and they are easy in their dressing? What do you say about that?
Yes, thank you very much. So it is important that ladies, women, mothers take care of their modesty, because again, the most important factor is human dignity. Our children must be imbibed with the fact that we need to preserve that dignity, as I've been saying before. And therefore, clothing is the apparent feature of the human being. Whatever is within should be reflected in without. So the way you dress, the way you cover yourself up is very important and shows that what respect you have of your own self as a human being. And therefore, if you cover yourself in the proper way, in an appropriate way, in a modest way, you will be showing that you within yourself, deep down in your heart and in your soul, you are a person who respects yourself and wants to maintain your respect and dignity as a human being. And when you show this model to your children, they will also be imbibed with the same sort of respect for themselves. So in our interactions with others, human dignity should be the main issue that has to be
reflected.
Everything else, freedom to dress as you like, should be again controlled by this factor that freedom, we can be free to unclothe at all like animals, but that does not preserve our dignity, does it?
Indeed.
So freedom, animal-like freedom, one of the great scholars, Shahid Mutahhari, said that if less clothes means civilization,
animals are more civilized.
Animals are the most civilized things. So therefore, we need to take care of this aspect that clothing is a reflection of our inner personality. So, especially for the teens, especially those who are very easily aroused, their sexual feelings are aroused at that age of when they're near to puberty, or they're entering the stage of puberty. So any sort of stimulus that causes that arousal has to be refrained from, especially by ladies, the girls of even the girls, sisters, siblings, they need to take care of that. And again, that does not mean that this modesty is
restriction.
Restriction.
So what?
It's not even restricted to girls, even boys today.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the same question, but let's have a sip of water, come back after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naqavi, and we're discussing something very important. Professor Naqavi, before going to the break, you said that it's not just girls, it's not just women who have to take care of their dressing in front of their mothers, in front of their sons or daughters, in front of their fathers. It's even boys and fathers.
Certainly. As far as ladies and girls are concerned, and their clothing should be such that it's not revealing those aspects of the body which create that stimulus. And even the contours of their body should be taken care of. You may be fully covered, but it's tight fitting and shows off your body contours, and that's also problematic. As far as boys are concerned, so anything they wear or how they dress, it may be it may stimulate the feelings of girls. So it's both ways. Their hairdressing, the way they dress, make their hair, that's also the way they keep a beard or they don't keep a beard or whatever. So everything which is, as I said, superficially that can be seen is creating these stimuli which have to be curtailed to control the feelings and not to stimulate them to come to a stage where they cannot be controlled. So of course, a girl or a boy wouldn't be if it's a religious family, he or she would not be going to express himself or herself within the house. Then he would be looking for opportunities and openings outside the house.
Yeah.
And that would be problematic.
Yes, indeed. So what gets clear over here is that even if there are mahrams, what has to be taken care of that they don't need to act as stimuli that creates that arousing or feeling inside the home or outside the home. So even if they are mahrams, you have to take care of a lot of things. You don't have to act as stimuli. The major thing that has to be taken care of is modesty.
So basically, we need to take, as I said, the major factor is human dignity, clothing, dressing is important. The way you talk, as I have been saying also before, the way you talk also stimulates people. In the Quran, it has been said the wives of the Holy Prophet have been addressed and they have been asked to manage the way they talk, the tone of their, لا تخضعن بالقول. And the way you talk should not be arousing.
All right.
So everything is important. All those things which are apparent, our behavior, actions, clothing is one of them, talking, the way we walk, the way we talk, it's important.
All right. So it's not just clothing here. It's clothing, it's walking, it's talking, it's your tone, it's everything.
Everything. Maybe you are wearing ornaments, jewelry.
All right.
Or you are using lipstick, or you're using other forms.
So you're trying to say that any small thing or big thing that acts as a stimuli, as you mentioned it, should be avoided.
Exactly.
Even if it's in front of your mahrams, avoiding, like, except your husband.
In our traditional families, it was very conventional that girls, ladies, would even cover their heads in front of their grandparents or grandfathers or whatever.
Indeed. So, I'm from the same culture and I know that. So let's discuss more about the culture with our audiences after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakavi. And before going to the break, we said an interesting point in the Asian cultures is that in the traditional families, which are joined, where almost people live together, girls covered their hairs or still cover their hairs in front of their grandparents or in front of their mahrams. Like I remember when we used to sit on our dinner table and our mother used to show us with her eyebrows that some of your flicks are showing off, your hair is visible. So we used to get curious and we used to cover our hair very properly, because our father was staying next to us. So I remember that modesty. I remember that culture of ours, which is kind of like one of the very good things. It actually covers all that modesty that we have been talking about.
It's not even peculiar to Muslim societies. Even Hindu traditional societies and many other religions, they observe hijab. Hijab is not something just typical for Muslims.
And even in Hindu culture, since I've been from India, in Hindu culture, the women of the house, be that in front of their mahrams, non-mahrams, whosoever, especially in front of the elders, they cover the entire face with the sari they are putting on, which is called as ghungat in our culture.
So that's it. I mean, this westernization of the society in many places, even in the East, those societies which have become westernized or they have become influenced by Western societies, you don't even have joint families now. And so many of the manners which are observed and learned in joint families, living with parents and grandparents, that's unfortunately in societies...
Fading out.
That's fading out. So that education, that upbringing which has to take place in families, in a joint family system, that's not taking place. Because certainly when a boy and a girl are married, they are young, they don't know many things. When they have their children, they don't know how to deal with them. But if they're living with their parents and the children who are born are living with their grandparents, they can teach them a lot of things that the parents can't do.
Exactly, because of the experience.
Because of the experience. So in traditional societies, especially in Asia, in India, Pakistan, such societies still maintain that traditional thing. So
that actually brings out all that modesty within itself. Well, I remember last night I was watching a video wherein an Indian couple was being asked by an American anchor that in your culture you live with your parents. How does that happen? And the beautiful answer that the male of the couple gives is that you live without your parents. How does that happen? So, yeah, it's actually parents who do so much for us, who sacrifice so many things for us. And then we all of a sudden, after getting married, forget each and everything, forget all those sacrifices. I'm not saying over here that we should be living with our parents after marriage, but taking care and being grateful to them always for all their sacrifices is something that's very, very important. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any message for us, any questions, any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also listen to this program again by logging into our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. There's a tab, COI, Call of Islam, wherein you can find our old programs. Well, you can also find us on these social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.